Hi, I'm Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. Today is Wednesday, December 18th, 2013, and this is the 13th episode of the show. You can find the show at theastrologypodcast.com, and you can also listen to us on iTunes. My guest today is astrologer, translator, and publisher Benjamin Dykes, and our topic is his recent publication of a translation of the third book of Hephaestus of Thebes, which is one of the earliest surviving texts on electional astrology. So Ben's website is bendykes.com, and this is his second time on the show. So Ben, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Hi, it's good to have you. I think you're my first interview, and we actually, last summer, I interviewed you on your book on essentially medieval electional astrology, but now I think we're going to be talking about an earlier form of electional astrology from the Hellenistic tradition. So let's talk about the book. What's the title of the book again?
Well, it's Apotelesmatics. That's the English version of the Greek word, and it's book three on inceptions.
Okay.
And Apotelesmatics roughly translates to outcomes or final outcomes. It has to do with interpreting the stars and from that interpreting what they mean and what will happen because of what they mean.
Sure, and especially based on the beginning or the inception of where the stars are placed at the moment that somebody initiates something, correct?
Right. There's overlap in the book, which I know we're going to talk about, between what seem like horary questions, elections, event charts, something called thought interpretation. All of these are broadly considered inceptions by Hephaestus.
Okay. And speaking of Hephaestus, so we're talking about Hephaestus of Thebes, although I think you named him or your title, you used the closer to the Greek, which is Hephaestion, correct?
Right. And that was a decision that I made with the translator, Eduardo Grimalia, and we just decided to go with that. We could have gone either way, but we settled on that.
Okay. And this is a translation of Hephaestus, the third book of Hephaestus of Thebes. Hephaestus wrote three books, I believe, in the 5th century, somewhere around, let's say, 415 CE. So let's talk a little bit about who are the translator and how did you go about basically producing this translation?
Well, the translator was Eduardo Grimalia. He's a professor of musical analysis in Argentina, and he has also, for some years, been translating Greek astrology works into Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to we worked together to produce this translation. It's our first joint work, and we worked out what. How we were going to translate certain words, what the procedure was going to be. But in the long run, it was Eduardo translating and then me editing, making commentary, writing the introduction, producing the book. So I acted more as the editor and publisher, even though obviously when we're looking at this kind of translation, I'm also thinking about how other languages are expressing some of these technical terms that Hephaestus is looking at, or that Hephaestus is using. So I was slightly more than an editor and a publisher, but mainly that.
Yeah, it really reminded me of some of the early Project Hindsight translations where you would see commentary in the footnotes by both Schmidt, who was the translator, as well as Hand, who was doing the editing. And oftentimes Hand would have a lot of insightful sort of commentary to make along the way. And that sort of seems like part of the role that you took in this translation, in addition to the editing, but also of providing some running commentary as well as the introduction, right?
Right. In some of the footnotes, I point the reader to maybe an alternative reading somewhere else, or I'll say, well, he's referring to something that Bonatti talks about or that, so-and-so talks about. So it is meant to be, it's meant to stand alone as a work on elections, but I also see it as part of my larger astrology project where there's lots of cross-referencing to other authors and other books.
Sure. and definitely showing some of the interactions between this book and what became of electional astrology in the medieval tradition was certainly an interesting point that you contributed to it. And I really appreciate also Eduardo's translation style. And I think it's great that he's also an astrologer, so that instead of just having, for example, an academic or two academics working on the translation, you have two people that have an academic background and have academic training, but you're also astrologers and you bring an interesting perspective to doing a translation like this, I think, as a result of that.
Yeah, there were some points at which, Hephaestion's Greek was obscure, or we weren't too sure at first what he was talking about. And if we weren't astrologers, it would have been easy to say, well, we'll just, word it like this and move on. But we had to sort of think as astrologers and try to figure out what does Hephaestion mean and what is he doing. So for me, that is always fun in translating, because it's not just about producing a book and writing down the words. It's trying to figure out what is this person's approach and what do they think about astrology? How are they using it?
Sure, exactly. Okay, great. And Eduardo had done a few other translations before. I know he had posted a translation of Serapio on the Hellenistic Astrology website at one point a few years ago, and I know he's definitely a good person that has a great background. I think he attended a Project Hindsight conclave sometime over a decade ago, and that was one of the things I remember him telling me that got him sort of motivated and interested in Hellenistic astrology, and then he went back and got some training in ancient languages after that, or probably around that time. So let's talk a little bit about the book itself. So this is the, as we said before, this is the third book of Hephaestion, so it's the third and last book, and this is a book that a lot of people have been waiting for. I mean, me especially, I've been waiting for a long time to see a translation of this book, because on the one hand, we've had books one and two, we've had translations of those for quite a while now. I think Robert Schmidt produced those in the mid to late 1990s, and those are largely on mundane astrology and natal astrology from Hephaestion. But this book is on specifically and almost entirely on the topic of electional astrology, or at least what we call electional astrology. But for Hephaestion, he referred to as catarchic astrology. Why don't we talk a little bit about that and a little bit about the structure of the book, I guess, let's start with.
Okay. The book begins with some general commentary by him on how to look at an inception chart, how to plan out an election, essentially. And in these early chapters, he's then also introducing thought interpretation, which is related to what we now call consultation charts. So about the first six chapters are basic rules and ideas about how to approach inceptional charts and event charts and thought interpretation. Everything else is listed by topic. If you want to ask someone for a favor, here's how you plan the election. If you want to buy something at the right price, here's how you do it, or here's how you plan the time for doing it. So there's generally an introductory section of several chapters, and then just chapter after chapter of topics.
Sure, and it's maybe like 50 chapters of topics or something like that?
Right, and it's, I think, 47. What we've also got in here, which maybe we can talk about in a moment, is we've got what are called Dorotheus excerpts and Dorotheus fragments, as well as some other things, too. I mentioned Dorotheus not only because it's he forms part of the appendices, but throughout Hephaestion, one of the notable things is that he's constantly quoting Dorotheus from the original Greek poem.
Sure.
Which is extremely rare. In fact, Hephaestion is our greatest source for the original Greek poem. And what is kind of fascinating for me is that the bits where he quotes Dorotheus' poem aren't the only Dorothean portions of the book. Because we also have Umar al-Tabari's Arabic translation, we can see that a lot of the regular paragraphs in the book are right out of Dorotheus. They are Hephaestio's rephrasing of the poem.
Right. And that's definitely, I think, the biggest reason that myself and a lot of other people have been waiting for this translation and are very glad that you were able to pull it together and do it, because it preserves, because Hephaestio himself didn't really write a lot of unique content on astrology, but instead he was more of a compiler from the later part of the Hellenistic tradition. And book three largely consists of Hephaestio either quoting directly or paraphrasing large parts of the fifth book of Dorotheus, which we don't have the original Greek version of. All we have is this Arabic version from the medieval tradition that has been altered and changed, and in which some material has been inserted, so that we don't always know what's original Dorotheus material and what's inserted by the later medieval tradition. So this is one of the things I think that your translation of Hephaestio will finally clear up, is what did Dorotheus originally say?
Right. And it's, yeah, and it's not just getting the astrology right, you know, if, you know, maybe there's a strange rule in the Arabic text and you're not sure if that's what Dorotheus means, and then maybe the Greek clears it up. There are other things too. For example, as I'm sure all the listeners know, in traditional astrology, there are a lot of verbs in Greek in particular, verbs for looking and seeing that have to do with aspects and various ways the planets are configured. And it can be easy to assume that each of these has its own very special technical meaning. And that's how some other writers and translators have taken this. But now that we actually have the poem from Dorotheus, who's very early, very authoritative, we can see that he often uses all sorts of words for looking and seeing with no particular difference between them. In fact, it seems he's probably picking and choosing his words so that the meter and number of syllables on each line of the poem works. So that was kind of an eye-opening thing. Mm-hmm. Not only can he can Hephaestio be a corrective to our existing Arabic Dorotheus, but it also gives insight into whether and how every astrologer took all of these looking and seeing words to be set in stone.
Sure. So help to clarify some of the early Greek technical terminology that you and I and people like Demetra George and others have been really focused on over the past few years and trying to understand things like the original aspect doctrine.
Yeah. I mean, it's, for example, you know, he may say in his poem, well, you might read in another text like Valens that at some point he'll say if a planet looks upon another planet, but then a few lines later it will talk about a planet scrutinizing another planet. And it could be easy to assume that looking upon and scrutinizing have got to be very different kinds of words. But if you read Dorotheus, you'll see that, no, he often uses them just interchangeably.
Sure. Well, yeah, so that, I mean, that will complete some interesting pieces just in terms of the early study of that Dorotheus text, since we couldn't do that previously, since all we have is the, up until now, the English translation of the Arabic translation of the Persian translation of the original Greek poem of Dorotheus from the first century.
Right.
So yeah, so that's a big thing that this publication will help to complete, is now what we have is Hephaestio, who largely either quoted excerpts of Dorotheus directly or did paraphrases of large parts of Dorotheus. Mm-hmm. And you included also, as you mentioned, an appendix where you had, what is it? It's basically like all of the existing Greek fragments of Dorotheus that Pingree in his critical edition had found, and you translated them into English.
It's not all of them. What Pingree did was there were two groups of material. When he published his Arabic Dorotheus, his English translation of Umar's Arabic in 1976, mm-hmm. he included long sections of what he called Dorotheus fragments. And then some years later, when he was doing research, he found another Greek manuscript which had sometimes lengthy, sometimes not, but prose quotes of Dorotheus's material. And he often knew that they were Dorotheus's material because he'd already translated the Arabic and Hephaestio. And these he called the Dorotheus excerpts.
Okay.
So what I did for this book is we translated most of the fragments, or many of the fragments, if they pertained to the selectional material. But we also translated all of the excerpts, but I only included the ones here, the only Dorothean excerpts that pertained to these topics in Hephaestio. So it isn't all of the fragments and excerpts, but it's many of them.
Okay. It's all of the ones that pertain to Book 5 of Dorotheus, or that may have been related to Book 3 of Hephaestio.
Right. And what I plan to do in the future is to produce a kind of reconstructed Dorotheus using lots of Arabic and Greek material, including this. So I will be using the excerpts and the fragments, all of them, in the future for a kind of reconstructed Dorotheus.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to that. And that's important. I mean, just in case anyone who's listening doesn't understand the significance of that, it's important because Dorotheus is one of the earliest, it's not only one of the earliest texts on Western astrology that has survived largely intact into the present day, but it's also easily one of the most influential texts on the later tradition, both on the Hellenistic tradition and the number of later Hellenistic authors who cited from Dorotheus and drew on his work, but also especially the number of medieval authors who drew on Dorotheus for different topics, like for natal astrology or for medieval astrology and so on and so forth, or for electional astrology and so on and so forth. So,
yeah, as a matter of fact, it is hard to understate the influence of Dorotheus because, for example, Masha'Allah is known to have translated the Persian Dorotheus as well, not just Umar, but Masha'Allah also. And yet we're always told that this version of Masha'Allah's is lost. Nobody knows what happened to it. But I believe that when we open up books of medieval astrology by people like Masha'Allah, Saul, Al-Hayat, other people, Al-Rijal on elections, we are actually reading Masha'Allah's translation. And I make an argument separately in a couple of other books that Masha'Allah just repurposed Dorotheus's material directly into his material on questions and elections and nativities and so on. So we have a lot of Dorotheus material that does go under his name, like Umar's translation. But we also have Dorotheus permeating all of the other branches, or most of the other branches, in medieval astrology, and he isn't explicitly named. So it's hard to underestimate the influence of his work. If there was no Dorotheus, we would probably barely have half of what we do have of medieval astrology.
Yeah, especially of elections and of horary.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, certainly horary would be only the faintest reflection of what it is now, and likewise elections.
And we'll clarify why that is later. I just wanted to insert a quick statement because to give people some idea of the relative importance of Dorotheus and therefore the relative importance of this publication that preserves a lot of Dorotheus material. I'm trying to think next to, outside of Ptolemy, Dorotheus probably really is the second most important and most influential astrologer in terms of the extent of his influence on the later tradition. I still think Ptolemy would probably outweigh Dorotheus if you took into account also some of his astronomical influences and everything else, but Dorotheus would probably be the second most influential astrologer in terms of the transmission of his work to the subsequent traditions. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think in some ways I think it's a toss-up. You could easily argue that Dorotheus was more important, but it's they're very close.
Sure. Okay. So so it's very important, and one of the reasons for, and I guess the main reason for this, and maybe we should get into this discussion since we've already mentioned it, is that there's been this question about, and one of the most important things that this translation of Hephaestion is finally able to answer, is the question of when did horary astrology originate? And did it originate in the Hellenistic tradition? Did it exist as a separate branch or even as a practice in the Hellenistic tradition? Or is horary something that does not show up in the existing texts that have survived in the present day? And therefore, does it seem like it developed later in the medieval tradition? Dorotheus or Hephaestion is one of the last texts that we knew really could answer this question one way or another, because Hephaestion preserved so much of this earlier material from Dorotheus. And in some of the Arabic text of the same material, there are references to horary. But the question for a long time has been, will the same material in Hephaestion, will it contain the same references to horary, or will those references be absent? Will they be missing? Will it turn out that they were later insertions from the medieval tradition once horary had already been introduced? Right. So what was the conclusion? I mean, you've spent quite a bit of time in your introduction dealing with this question.
Right. If by horary or questions, we're looking for a developed branch of astrology, kind of in the way that nowadays you might specialize in horary, or in Lilly's time or Bonatti's time, or even someone like Masha Allah in the 700s. If by horary you mean that, the answer is no. There is no evidence of procedural textbooks on horary with standardized lists of questions prior to people like Masha Allah in the 700s. Not that I've seen, and certainly not in Hephaestion. However, there are a couple of places. There are two places in particular where the way he frames the inception reads almost exactly like a horary a chart, a horary question. And there are other places in the book where when he's talking about what we'd call consultation charts or thought interpretation and predicting some outcomes of things, this starts to overlap with what would later become horary. So full-blown horary of the kind that you can learn and study and specialize in does not exist in this book, but there is a lot more that overlaps with it and would become part of horary astrology later.
Sure. And my biggest surprise, because I'd worked with Hephaestion before, I had never had a full translation of it, but I had gone through the text with Schmidt and just sight read it to see if any of the passages in the Arabic version of Dorotheus that had references to horary. There's like, because it's really weird, because it's only there's only 40 chapters or something in the Arabic version of Dorotheus on elections in book 5, and only 5 or 6 of those chapters contain references to horary. The rest of it's clearly just on electional astrology, but the title of book 5 of Dorotheus in the Arabic manuscript has been changed to say that it's on questions, even though the majority of the book and even the first sentence or two says explicitly that it's on inceptions or elections.
Yeah, and this is actually an important a point to make, is that if... This is why I phrased my earlier answer the way I did. If by question, you talk about a question chart, if by question you just mean any kind of consultation with an astrologer, period, or any kind of question you might ask, well then sure, the book is full of questions because it's about people coming to the astrologer for help. So when we read things like, in Arabic, that book 5 of Dorotheus is on questions, which is the Arabic word that they use, we have to be very careful about what we mean. It does mean that someone is inquiring of the astrologer, sure, but it is not a complete full-blown manual on what we would call the branch of horary.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and it's just not. I mean, I think that was an error in the Arabic version to say that that book was on questions, mm-hmm. because it even clarifies in the first, like I said, two or three sentences that it's on inceptions or elections. But the big surprise for me, since this is this is one of the earliest research papers that I wrote that I really published and put out there, was in 2007, my paper on the origins of horary. And in that paper, I argued and I pointed out that I think for one of the first times, partially drawing on Pingree's work, but also drawing on just any available Hellenistic text that we had in translation, and as well as some that we didn't at the time, that references to horary seem to be conspicuously absent in the Hellenistic tradition, and right. therefore drawing the conclusion that it probably didn't exist, certainly as an independent branch in the Hellenistic tradition. And one of the texts that sort of was looked at, or that I looked at with Schmidt, was the Hephaestio text, in order to see if any of the material that Hephaestio preserved indicated that there was horary in Dorotheus in the first century, as it seems in the Arabic text. And the conclusion that we came to was that the answer was no. One of the biggest surprises for me in your translation, and one of the things that this translation has cleared up and finally provided an answer to, is this one instance. There's only one strong instance, and you provide a really good analysis of all of the different possible instances in which there could be references to horary throughout the Hephaestio text, and you sort of analyze them and talk about which ones are ambiguous and which ones are not. But the one reference which comes in, I believe it's book 3, obviously, of Hephaestio, chapter 11, on the topic of it's on separations.
Right.
There is one clear reference to horary, and that's the biggest thing that your publication has changed for me, is that I have to concede now that is definitely a reference to horary. And what's terrible about it, in a way, partially for me, or at least is somewhat humbling about it, is that I was aware of this reference. I've been aware of it since 2006, 2007. But one thing that Schmidt always pointed out to me, and which I always took for granted, is that in the footnotes, or in the critical apparatus that Pingree included in his critical edition, Pingree pointed out that in one of the manuscript traditions, that in the P, I think it's the P manuscript or the X manuscript tradition. X. Which
X.
one?
Yeah, it's X.
Okay, right. In the X manuscript tradition, that so in the actual manuscript, in the one that Pingree compiled of what he thought, his reconstruction of what the original text says, it says their separations and returns. So it's about when basically a wife leaves her husband, and the two have a separation, and the husband wants to know if the wife will come back to him.
Right.
And Dorotheus gives these instructions, and he says, or Hephaestio does, he says, their separations and returns are to be examined in the following manner. In the inception in which the separation occurs, or else at the time that someone inquires from you, look at Venus and the sun, and then he goes on and on and gives you instructions. But right. in that, he first says, look at the inception, or look at the chart, the event chart for when the separation occurs, when the wife leaves her husband. But then he says, or if you don't have that, basically look at the chart for the time that the husband comes to you, the astrologer, and inquires about that question. So that's a clear reference to horary in those manuscripts. And I had always been under the impression that there was a major alternate manuscript tradition which omitted the second phrase about casting a chart for when the client approaches you, essentially with a question about this topic. But one of the things that you guys clarified is that that is not actually a strong enough manuscript tradition to rely on, because so many of the other manuscripts include the horary reference, and also because the other manuscript tradition, the alternate one, is kind of a minor tradition, right?
Yeah, what Pingree pointed out in his description of his manuscripts is that this manuscript X, that he's labeled X, is the only one that omits that phrase, or else at the time that someone inquires from you. Every other manuscript includes it. Mm-hmm. But that this manuscript X, not only is it the only one that omits it, so you should be suspicious about omitting it that way. But X itself only has little tiny bits of Hephaestio that are stuck in the midst of material on Valens. So it's not as though manuscript X even, represents a sustained version of Hephaestio. So it seems to me that, yes, this phrase should be here, or else at the time that someone inquires from you. But on the other hand, remember that Hephaestio calls this an inception. And the inception is the action taken by the wife. She's undertaken an action. It's an event chart or an action. And so we could treat it just as a straightforward election or event chart where the husband says, here's when she left, what will be the outcome? And what this seems to suggest is maybe the kind of way that horary astrologers started. He alludes to this in some other places, that if you don't know the time of the event, if the client doesn't know the time, then use the time that the client has come to you. And that is not really full blown horary. That's more like, well, if you can't do anything else and you have to cast a chart, you might as well cast it for the time that they come to you.
Right. Yeah. You provide actually some really good insight into that with the other chapter that you say should be taken into account along with chapter 11, which is chapter 47 on runaway slaves, because it shows the that there's different levels of like a hierarchy of inceptions that you should use if you have them available. But then if you don't, then you default to like what is essentially a lesser starting point or a lesser inception. And right. There's actually, it ends up being like a stratification of three or four different possible inceptions. And then eventually, if none of those are available, then you use just the chart for when the client approaches you.
Right. If you're the astrologer, you need to use some chart. So what's it going to be? That basically, so you have this hierarchy. And something like this also happens in later horary too. In fact, it was even there amongst the Persians and Arabs. And that is that if someone comes to you and they have questions that you would normally use the natal chart for, like when will I get married or will I have money, that kind of thing. Well, if that client doesn't have their nativity, what are you going to do? Well, they would cast what we now call a question chart or horary chart, and they called it a universal question or a general question. So the question chart is a second best alternative to having the actual nativity. And here in Hephaestio, casting a chart for the time of the consultation is second best to knowing when the wife ran away or when the slave ran away.
Right. And actually, in certain context, it might be third best, because in chapter 4, yeah, which is on runaway slaves, the first instruction he gives is to cast the chart for when the slave runs away. Mm-hmm. And that's the primary chart, is the event chart for when the slave departs in order to determine if the slave will return to the master or what have you. Then in sentence 51 in chapter 47, mm-hmm, there's a brief sentence or two where it gives instructions saying that if the time in which the runaway departed is not known, then you should use the time for when the master first found out that the slave was missing.
Exactly.
And that's the second best sort of inception chart within that context. Mm-hmm. So that's almost like the second. And then you must wonder then if the chapter 11 consideration would come in third, if you don't even know that time. Mm-hmm. Then the third best option is, if you don't have the chart for when the event happened, if you don't have the time for when the person realized that the event had happened, then the third best thing is you could maybe cast a chart for when the person comes to the astrologer asking them for help figuring out when things will be fixed.
Right. So I have no problem saying that horary existed in a kind of generalized way, just in the sense that you have to cast a chart. You need some kind of chart. If you can't have the preferred chart, cast it for the time of the consultation. Or that they might have taken the thought interpretation techniques, which are very clear in Hephaestio, and later on adapted that to the topic of to Horary, so that later on you get the full blown branch that you can read about and learn on your own or from a teacher. But at this stage, it's still the Horary chart is either the second or third best chart. There's no developed doctrine, or they're still stuck at the stage of doing thought interpretation.
Sure. And I definitely want to talk about thought interpretation, because that's the other thing that this book goes into quite a bit that's really exciting, seeing that in the early tradition and also seeing that as kind of a precursor to Horary. But before we get away from chapter 11, I do just want to say, even though on the one hand, this is literally the only clear reference, the clear unarguable, unambiguous reference to Horary in the entirety of this book, and therefore even in the entirety of Dorotheus. Mm-hmm. To me, this is still a clear reference to Horary. This is a clear reference to the idea underlying that eventually became this separate branch of Horary, this fourth branch of astrology, was clearly there in Hephaestio. And in fact, when I checked it, it matched the Arabic text. The sentence matched the Arabic text so well that I think it probably was what Dorotheus originally said as well, mm-hmm. which means that this reference, even if it was only a single reference to being able to cast a chart for when somebody comes to you with a question about whether their wife will return to them, that's enough to tell me that something like Horary was already developing as early as the first century CE. And mm-hmm. in that, I have to really... You know, it's very humbling for me. I think, but perhaps many other people don't know. I have to sort of eat crow a bit because there have been some people over the past few years who have been saying that this reference is there. For example, Deborah Holding in a lecture at UAC last year in 2012 and Dorian Greenbaum have said this reference is there. Now, we may still disagree about some other references in other Hellenistic authors where there's sort of this debate about whether consultation charts or thought interpretation constitutes Horary. And there's still some room for debate over the extent to which other authors refer to Horary in the Hellenistic tradition. But when it comes to this, I have to now, I think, revise my position that I had adopted back in 2007 when I published that paper on Horary, that Horary did not exist at all as a concept in the Hellenistic tradition, or that the closest you get to it is the consultation chart or the thought interpretation. And now, just due to this single reference that you guys have published and the information about the manuscript tradition and everything else that you've given around it, I definitely have to revise that position and say that Horary, or at least the inklings, the starting point of Horary, does seem to have already existed by the first century.
Yeah, and I think you put it the right way a few sentences ago. You said the idea of Horary. Because, yeah, this one reference is not very much to hang one's hat on. And if you're looking for a Greek William Lilly, this is no evidence of that. So I think your general conclusions were still correct from that paper, because this is only one sentence, and it does only express a general idea of Horary. So I guess that would be my reaction to that.
Sure.
I think your general conclusion was still correct.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think you've in your publications on medieval texts on thought interpretation over the past few years, like The Search of the Heart and some of the other texts, and then even this one of the things that you did confirm about my argument that was unique, and some people, I think, give too much credit or thought that I was drawing entirely on Pingree for my argument about the origins of Horary, but that wasn't necessarily the case, because one of the unique things that I tried to argue is that Horary probably developed originally out of consultation charts and the thought interpretation framework. And that's one of the things that I think you've kind of shown in some of your works or medieval translations, is that there was a much larger branch of thought interpretation and consultation charts that existed as sort of a subset of electional or inceptional astrology in the early medieval tradition, and that it was kind of connected with the Horary tradition in a way, so that argument that I made that Horary may have partially grown out of the idea of consultation charts was sort of confirmed by that.
Yeah, and it was, and actually it was only after understanding your argument and hearing about that, that I began to see thought interpretation all over the place and recognize it for what it was. So yeah, I think we could also say, and we could look at Hephaestio as an example of this, developed thought interpretation techniques that also include predicting the outcomes of thoughts and the outcomes of plans, that can be used as a kind of early template for horary.
Sure. And that's one of the sort of debates that's happening right now. And you've made some interesting distinctions where you'll generally distinguish between thought interpretation slash, let's say, consultation charts versus predicting outcomes from that versus event charts. And then finally versus full-blown horary questions. Mm-hmm. And one of the debates, for example, that we've been having recently, like, for example, Deborah Holding takes the position that there is no distinction between horary astrology proper and a consultation chart. Whereas I sort of see those two as being conceptually different. And I think you've sort of adopted that position as well in distinguishing most of the time between thought interpretation being one thing and horary astrology proper being something different, right?
Yeah, I do see them as different. They're procedurally different. They have different rules. For people who use both methods, thought interpretation comes first. So thought interpretation is definitely distinct from horary. Even if you're a working astrologer, if someone comes to you and you do a consultation chart as they walk in the room and they're already telling you the question, well, then, you know, the thought interpretation and the question and the consultation all kind of mixes together. So it might be that in real life, many times you won't see the difference. But in a lot of these texts, they're very clear. Thought interpretation techniques are different, and that they often need to come first. And interpreting and identifying someone's thought is different from predicting the outcome of it.
Right.
In fact, in Hephaestio, in chapter 3, so book 3, chapter 3, he talks about what he calls irrational inceptions. And this just seems really strange because he's saying you cast this chart and then from it you determine whether or not this is an irrational person or it's an irrational action, which seems kind of weird because wouldn't you already know through talking with them whether this was, you know, wouldn't you already know that if they were talking to you? Mm-hmm. So I think what this chapter has to do is it is like a consultation chart in which you are interpreting whether or not this person's plans and ideas are even sound enough to be carried out.
Right. And that chapter was exciting because to me that indicated or that looked like a precursor to what became later in horary, the considerations before judgment.
Right, yeah.
So literally just things that you take into account that give mm-hmm. you some idea about what the client is thinking or what their intentions are. Mm-hmm. And in some in instances, if their thoughts or their intentions are not good, then it sort of alerts the astrologer to this ahead of time.
Right. I mean, in this short little chapter, it's only three sentences long, but it's very clear. He's not saying, you know, look at the Lord of the Ascendant and see if it connects with the Lord of the Tenth, and that'll tell you whether the action is irrational. This is a chapter about identifying an irrational client, even apart from whatever it is they want to do. So it's almost like it doesn't matter whether they think they want to get married or ask a favor or get a job. If this consultation chart shows that they are irrational people to begin with, then yeah, it's like a consideration before judgment. It's a warning sign.
Sure. And that's definitely still the rooted very much in the consultation chart itself, the chart cast for the inception of the consultation.
Right. Right. There's nothing horary-like about this kind of consultation chart because you're diagnosing what's in the head. You're diagnosing the sanity of the client,
right?
Quite apart from whatever their question happens to be. So this is a good example of how thought interpretation be absolutely distinct from whatever the client wants to do or know about.
Sure. And there's actually, it's very exciting because it's the most extensive. There's a very long chapter in which Hephaestio gives rules for determining also what's on the client's mind or what they're thinking about based on the 12th part that's rising at the time of the consultation, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and you can see again how this could be procedurally and conceptually different from horary. Suppose you cast a chart. A consultation chart for when the client arrives, and you use these 12th parts to identify a kind of broad topic. Well, this can be a guide for you while the client is talking. I mean, what if the client comes to you and is confused and goes into a 20-minute discussion? Well, now 20 minutes have gone by, and that can mean the difference between having one ascendant versus another when you can't finally cast the question chart. So it might take a while to narrow down what exactly the question even is. But what the consultation chart with the 12th parts does is identify at least a broad range of things to begin with.
Sure. And one of the other issues that came up, or one of the other things that I kind of have to backtrack on that I had taken as a position in the horary paper that I think is also interesting, is that because all of this is being contextualized within the context of the word katarke, or the word that you're translating consistently, and I usually also would prefer to translate as inception or beginning, that this entire book is on inception. So casting a chart for the inception of event or the moment that an event is initiated or takes place, under the assumption that either you can proactively pick an auspicious date to initiate something, or an auspicious moment, or that you can retrospectively look at an event that has already begun if you know when it began, in order to determine what its outcome will be.
Yeah.
The fact that they do contextualize that one instance in chapter 11 of Hephaestio, where he says, look at the inception chart for when someone inquires about this topic to you, the astrologer, that means that they are using basically, or moving towards, a horary framework, or that the idea of horary is starting to come up as sort of like a proto-horary, mm-hmm. within the context of the word katarke or katarki. And mm-hmm. that's important to me because that's something that Geoffrey Cornelius spends a lot of time on in The Moment of Astrology, talking about the importance of this Greek term within the context of horary. And I kind of, he was emphasizing how it was used later in the Greek tradition in some of the horoscopes that are contained in Neugebauer and Van Hosen's work, Greek Horoscopes, in the, I think there's four or five charts from the 5th or 6th century attributed to Polycus, and like two or three of them are clearly horary questions. And Cornelius made a very big deal about this because they use the term katarke within the context of horary questions. And I sort of questioned whether or not we could use that as an example of, in order to understand Greek technical terminology and the full range of meaning of the term katarke. At the time, I questioned that, at least, although now this is another instance where I would say Cornelius was right in that horary was sort of a subset, in a way, of katarkic astrology in the early Hellenistic tradition, or eventually it developed out of that. However, the part where he might not like as much is that clearly, I think the Hephaestio text demonstrates that this term katarki is being used to refer to the sort of the chronological inception or beginning of an event in time as being an important moment, and that's something that's necessary, that you have to have some sort of inception moment in order to cast a chart and in order to be able to do any sort of astrological divination or what have you. So that's going to raise a lot of interesting discussions now that are going to be revived about Cornelius's use of that term and the extent to which this notion of inceptions is tied into horary, I guess.
Well, in one way, you could look at it this way. If you go to that chapter 11 about the runaway wife, Hephaestus calls it an inception. Well, what part of it is an inception? Is it the client? Is it the husband coming to you? No, that's not the inception. The inception or undertaking was the wife's leaving. And so what the guy is doing when he comes to you is he is asking about an event that has already happened that he is in the midst of, and he wants insight into what's going to happen. And what we could say is that this is a kind of, if we generalize that situation, we get essentially a horary consultation. Because what does someone come to the astrologer for? They say, well, these are the things that have been happening, and I'm in the midst of them now, and I want to know what's going to happen. So that we could generalize this thought and say that any horary consultation is also an inception.
Right.
Not because the word is ambiguous, but because people are only there because of something else that has been undertaken in the past that is affecting them now.
Sure.
And you know, this is something that you look at in a horary chart. You look at the separations and applications of the moon. And Dorotheus talks about this. So when the moon separates from a planet, that shows you what has been happening. Hephaestus does the same thing, I think, with the 11th house or the 9th house in one of the early chapters. So I'm averse to just glossing all of this stuff as being catharchic astrology. Mm-hmm. Because there are enough differences between thought interpretation, predicting outcomes, horary, and, you know, straight up elections and event charts. All of those things are distinct. And so even though they might have this common thread of the concept of undertakings running through them, I don't think that that means we should just gloss all of it as being catharchic.
Sure. Yeah. And I definitely wasn't trying to say that. I was just saying that one of the points that on the one hand, in Cornelius's book, The Moment of Astrology, he tries to adopt the term catharche as being this very important term for understanding and gaining insight into horary astrology. And he goes in a certain direction with it about the ceremonial and sort of spiritual or other sort of meanings that might be associated with it, while at the same time trying to reject the notion that the idea of temporal moments of origin is the conceptual or philosophical basis for astrology. And
right.
So on the one hand, I'm backtracking and saying, you know what, you were right, that catharche is more important for horary than earlier acknowledged, than I earlier acknowledged. But then I'm also on the other hand, pushing back and saying, however, it turns out that if you're going to go that direction, and that seems to be true to some extent, that then that actually ties astrology even closer to this notion of temporal moments of origin mm-hmm. than previously thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we can look to the astrologers themselves and their explicit statements to show that. One of them, again, would be this some of the thought interpretation material where they're talking about how to interpret what's recently happened, or with the runaway wife. The catharche is what the wife did at a particular time, and you need to know the time.
Right.
Or, you know, in Ptolemy, when he talks about the birth, the nativity as a catharche, because it is something that is subsequent to the conception. They're not using this in a ritual sense. They're tying it to actual moments,
right? Symbolically significant moments at the beginning or the inception of some event or some venture in time. And that's actually explicitly stated in that sentence we keep coming back to that does have the clear reference to horary. It says, if you want to figure out if the person's wife will come back to you, it says, look at in the inception in which the separation occurs. So either you're looking at the inceptional chart for the moment that the wife left her husband, or else at the time that someone inquires from you. So again, it brings it back to this temporal moment of someone approaching you to talk as the astrologer, to talk about this question at that moment as having some sort of symbolic significance that you can draw from astrologically.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the bit about the runaway slave does something similar, because what you prefer is the inception chart for the moment the stuff was stolen. But if not, and this is an interesting variation, if not, you take the time when the owner of it found out.
Right.
And what that means is that you're taking the time when the when it became a problem for the owner.
Right.
Or became a problem in the owner's mind. So they need a time, and the time has got to be closely related to, you know, when these things became a problem. Although, I mean, I could see Cornelius's point maybe for the if we're talking about the chart of when the owner found out about it, because the goods are already stolen, they're gone.
Right.
But when you find out about it, could be a more symbolic kind of event, a symbolic moment. But nevertheless, they're clear that what I like about these passages is that they don't just tell you when to cast the chart. They're giving you some options, and we're able to interpret why certain options might be better than others.
Sure. And that's really what's very exciting to me about this translation. And one of the reasons why I think everyone should get it is just those little statements that you can pick up provide such important and sort of profound, have the potential to provide such profound insights into the theoretical and philosophical conceptualizations of horary astrology, or not horary, but of astrology in general, of electional astrology for one, but then also some of the broader implications that that may have for the our understanding and conceptualization of astrology and what it does in general. And we're certainly, I don't want to do, we're sort of glossing over some of Cornelius's arguments, and I don't want to do disservice to it by giving it such a brief treatment in our little time here, but that was just a little piece that I thought this is definitely going to become relevant to some of the arguments he made in that book 20 years ago. And I think your book will help to both on the one hand solve and affirm some of the questions and the points that he raised, but also on the other hand, there may be some other points where we'll have to go back and discuss again. So moving on a little bit and just the last little bit of time here, I just wanted to talk about one of the other things, which is just it's really interesting to me from a technical standpoint as an astrologer, the reoccurring approach that comes up over and over again in the different topics for different types of elections. Oftentimes, the main focus of the election is not on things like figuring out what house, which of the 12 houses matches the topic of whatever you're trying to start. But instead, almost every election is framed within the context, or many, maybe the majority of the elections are framed within the context of just looking at the four angular houses and having the first house indicate the one who initiates the action, having the seventh house oftentimes indicate the other party who's receiving the action, having the 10th house indicate something about the quality of the action, and then the 4th house indicating something about the outcome. Mm-hmm. And that framework comes up over and over again, and it's a really fascinating framework that provides a lot of insight into early electional astrology, because it's almost, I almost got the sense that it was almost coming from a strata of the early astrological tradition, perhaps around the time of Dorotheus or before the time of Dorotheus, when the concept of the four angles was there, and they were placing a lot of emphasis on those four angular places, the rising sign, the setting sign, the culminating sign, and the anti-culminating sign. But they're not necessarily putting a lot of emphasis on the other houses, at least not for topics, or not topically.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if you had any. I mean, do you think that's true, that maybe the majority of the elections really seem to focus on the four angles and not so much the rest of the houses?
It could be related to this idea of solar motion or diurnal motion. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the action that is arising would obviously be the ascendant, you know, the midheaven being the culmination point would be something more like the purpose or the action that you are striving for or the success that you're striving for. Mm-hmm. The fourth house at at one point in I think one of the thought interpretation chapters, he says that the fourth house is also hidden things that you don't know about. Obviously, that's symbolic of the sun being below the earth.
Right.
So there's something going on that you don't see. So it could be that they were using these the symbolism and the metaphors involved in diurnal motion to structure their elections. And that's certainly something that could go way back.
Sure. Yeah, it raises some interesting, there's some interesting historical questions about the development of astrology that raises for me, since this comes from Dorotheus, who himself claimed to have been drawing from an earlier strata of the tradition, both from the Mesopotamian stream and the Egyptian stream, according to his introductory remarks in the Arabic text. And so it sort of made me wonder if there wasn't something that someone at some point may be able to work out or make an argument about in terms of either the development of electional astrology, and perhaps this indicating that it comes from an earlier strata, perhaps very early on, or even just drawing from strands just before the Hellenistic tradition, going back to the Mesopotamian tradition, or perhaps that you could draw some implications in terms of the development of the houses, where some people often do argue that the angles were developed and established first before they really had developed an understanding of what the other significations of the other houses were. And so perhaps this could play some role. The fact that they only really focus on the four angular houses in this early electional work could tell us something about the development of the use of the houses and what came first chronologically or what have you.
Right.
These aren't sort of fully developed conclusions or thoughts that I've worked out, but it's just little things that came up to me as I was reading your translation.
Well, and it reminds me of something I believe in Bonatti, where he points out, he says, older authors keep, whenever they look at their questions and elections, they keep focusing on the angular houses, and they need to be, he's basically saying they need to broaden their view and pick some different houses for some of these questions.
Right.
So it was something that Bonatti, I believe it was Bonatti, was noting and seemed to be a bit irritated by.
Yeah, I could easily see how somebody, even myself, just any normal astrologer, any astrologer who does modern electional astrology or even medieval electional astrology, if you read this book, you will see a type of electional astrology that's notably different in some ways technically from what we're used to. And that's because it's coming from such an early strata of the astrological tradition from the first century CE and even before that. It looks a little bit different, but in that you can really see the origins of what became of electional astrology for the next 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, very exciting. So I think we're getting towards the end of our hour. So one of the things that I did want to ask you about is what you're planning on working on next, what sort of projects you have lined up for the future, both on your own in terms of your own translation efforts, but also in terms of with Eduardo, and if the two of you plan on doing additional translations of other Hellenistic texts.
Yes, we have a lot of things planned, both worked on jointly, or in my case, I will be producing a translation of Firmicus Maternus.
Nice.
But we already have it planned that we are going to do a number of other Greek works together, including the works of Theophilus, who is a big question mark, really. It's a kind of a blank spot in the history of astrology, and an important one because he was writing in Greek during a period when everyone else was moving into Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
So he was living at the same time as people like Masha'Allah and Umar al-Tabari, but he was still writing in Greek. So there's all sorts of information that's going to be in his books. So we're going to be working on Theophilus as well as a number of other things together. And then I'm going to soon, after I finish the next two mundane books, my medieval series will be complete that I projected several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to work on a lengthy Arabic series, as well as later on or occasionally a later medieval, early modern Latin series.
Okay. From the late medieval, early Renaissance period.
Yeah, translating John of Eschenden and and Cardan and you know, the some of the primary sources that that William Lilly was using, and those folks from the later medieval, early modern period.
Okay. And you recently, I guess a few months ago, back in August, you released your first book in the series on mundane astrology, and you're working on the second volume right now, right?
Yes. Yeah, and that is going to have a lot more from Arabic. I plan on translating the complete book 8 of Al-Rijal, which is the mundane section of his large book. And this second volume is going to focus on conjunctional theory and time lord systems, and how to interpret, you know, annual ingress charts. So this is going to be very meaty, and it's going to be more narrowly focused on that material, whereas the first volume was on a number of techniques which were not always closely related.
Okay.
All of them derived somehow or another from Ptolemy and his mundane writings. But the topics were somewhat separate. Volume 2 is going to focus on time lords and conjunctions and ingresses.
Excellent. Well, that's exciting because there wasn't a lot. I mean, the Hellenistic tradition was very much primarily focused on natal astrology and then secondarily maybe on elections. But you don't get a lot of medieval or mundane astrology until the medieval tradition, where you have these huge, fully worked out approaches to the subject. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ptolemy does talk about he talks about ingresses, but what he wants is the lunation, the chart for the lunation that was just prior to the seasonal ingress, and so he focuses more on new moon and full moon charts. But even so, and this was picked up by the Persians and the Arabs, but I'm not aware offhand of other people in the ancient world who followed him in that. Mm-hmm. So even though he was talking about those kinds of charts, it was really the Persians and the Arabs who started developing the material more fully.
Sure. And worked out the full Jupiter-Saturn cycle and everything else.
Right.
Which is good timing that you're publishing these, since we're due for another conjunction here in just a few years, like 2020, right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
So, yeah, and in my book, I will explain and have lots of tables that explains the different kinds of conjunctions and when to expect each conjunction, depending on whether you use tropical or sidereal and all of that sort of thing.
Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, I guess that does it for our show. So thanks for coming on to talk about your book on Hephaestion of Thebes.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the Astrology Podcast. Thank you for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show, then just enter your email address on the sidebar of theastrologypodcast.com. Please check out Ben's website, and I'll put up a link where you can order the book from there at bendykes.com. If you enjoyed this episode, then please go give it a good rating on iTunes. And that's it. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.